So hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings rise to our current challenges and making as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. And at this point, I've now held 60 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'll be joined by Michael Murphy, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation we're calling The Future of Human Evolution. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Mike, and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up after about 90 minutes. Michael Murphy can be regarded as one of the primary founding fathers of the human potential movement. He co-founded Esalen Institute in 1962 with Richard Price, and so he's done pioneering work now for over five decades into all aspects of human transformation. Encounter groups came out of that work, Gestalt therapy. The early Buddhist and Hindu teachers who came to the United States really found their home at Esalen, and the whole field of somatics arose out of that. What we know about being in the zone, the mysticism of transcendent athletes, found a home there. He's been profiled in The New Yorker, featured in magazines and journals worldwide. I remember reading about him and Esalen in Look magazine when I was still in high school, living in York Center, Illinois. And those articles were written by George Leonard, his lifelong friend and compadre and a teacher also to me. And with George, he created the first systematic integral approach to long-term practice, integral transformative practice, starting in 1992. My work with Ken Wilber on integral life practice built on that important foundation. And I participated in that original group for 2 years later. That's how I first met Mike and learned a great deal from him. In terms of his own influences, prior to graduating from Stanford University, he studied at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in South India, where he developed the spiritual and philosophical foundations that led to the founding of Esalen and have informed the rest of his career. In the 1980s, with his wife Dulce, he helped organize Esalen's pioneering Soviet-American exchange programs, which became a premier vehicle for citizen-to-citizen connections. In 1989, Boris Yeltsin's first visit to the United States was sponsored by Esalen Institute. He's written a number of important nonfiction books, The Future of the Body, The Life We Were Given, In the Zone, and The Physical and Psychological Effects of Meditation. And his fiction book, Golf in the Kingdom, which has been released as a movie just last year, quite an accomplishment. Congratulations on that, Mike. And The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons, another book about golf and non-ordinary consciousness. Also Jacob Adibit and An End to Ordinary History. More personally, one of the things I really love about Mike Murphy is that he proves that cosmic consciousness can be eminently grounded and sane. So many people whose minds go wide lose their practical moorings a little bit, but Mike always stays very grounded, balanced, careful, rigorous, sincere, self-critical, and he's incredibly knowledgeable and passionate. I always feel like I walk away from a conversation with him having benefited in terms of education, sanity, and inspiration all at once. He's really an integral human being. And never one to rest on his laurels, he's been at work this past year or so on a wonderful summary of the big picture of the worldview that really informs all his work and pretty much all the conversations we're having here, and how that relates to the sometimes more reductionistic worldviews that are more dominant in mainstream culture. He calls it the emergence of evolutionary panentheism, and we'll get into into that a little later on. Welcome, Mike. I'm so happy to have you with me on this program.
Good morning, Terry. That was quite a lovely introduction there.
Well, good. I'm glad. Yeah. You know, Mike, as you look back on nearly 50 years of dynamic innovation during which you've had such an amazing and pioneering effect on contemporary culture, I'm wondering what right now is feeling most meaningful. You know, what are you proudest of? What things loomed large in the moment but now seem less significant? I'm curious how your perspective has shifted.
Well, the same fundamental worldview that got me started when I was at Stanford. I was just 19, 20, an undergraduate, and through the teacher there, Frederick Spiegelberg, and then introduced to the work of Sri Aurobindo, the great Indian philosopher, political leader, and mystic. That worldview that I'm choosing to call evolutionary panentheism, that is the doctrine that the divine is both transcendent to and immanent in the universe, that vision of things has remained the same, Terry, through these, well, and now 60 years. It's filled in, as it were, pixel by pixel, you know, as it's emerged for me out of the mist. That has remained constant. Now, I've had many enthusiasms along the way, as you know, and some of yesterday's enthusiasms seem very small indeed to my viewpoint now. But certain things have grown in interest to me and have grown in prominence. But this underlying fundamental vision has essentially remained the same. But as I say, it's gotten fleshed out. Now, there's a lot to say about all of that, and I'm sure we'll cover some of it, you know, in this hour. And then I could talk, Terry, about what's right front and center for me right now, if you like.
Well, please. I mean, you've opened up the space. What is front and center for you right now?
Well, okay. If people were to ask me, you know, what is my greatest disappointment over these, particularly the 50 years since we started Esalen, it would be that the enthusiasm that was shared by many, many people back in the early 1960s around what we call the big vision, this vision of evolutionary panentheism, that degree of enthusiasm, which extended into the heart of mainstream media, has faded away today, Terry, and it's receded to the margins. Now, it's in those margins, I say, that we are living, your work, my work, ITP that George and I started, Ken Wilber's work, and all that. You don't find front and center at Harvard, Stanford, the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, or in the pulpits of our mightiest churches. In, let's say, the thought leaders in academia, journalism, in philosophy, and in the great religious traditions are not explicitly rooted here. Whereas in those days, when Esalen started, for example, Time magazine was almost like the village newspaper in America. There was a man of the week each week, and, you know, they were selling some tens of millions of copies of Time magazine. And eight people who were on the cover of Time magazine led seminars at Esalen. Arnold Toynbee, who was arguably the most famous historian of the day, worldwide back in the early 60s, was telling us that the coming of Buddhism to the West would be the most important event in the world history of the late 20th century. Paul Tillich, who came to Esalen, was telling us that the great task ahead for all theology and philosophy was the joining of the great vision of the onward advance of humankind represented by the Judeo-Christian heritage and the great view of the world subsumption in Brahman, Nirvana, and so forth, the circular, he called it, symbols of the world represented by the East. Those two would be brought into an explosive, world-transforming union. That was the great work ahead. Paul Tillich. I could go on and on. There were eight of these people talking this way on the cover of Time magazine. That kind of conversation is no longer front and center. It is much alive in the worlds you and I inhabit, Terry, and for the listeners to this program. That kind of thinking, this what we finally call the big vision, but not if you pick up today's copy of the New York Times or if you listen to most of the sermons in the churches or if you read the curricula in at Princeton or Harvard or Stanford or UC Berkeley or anywhere else. So that, to me, is a disappointment. For me, it's to view an enormous cultural meander because with its moving off to the periphery, a lot of initiatives that were giving us information about our greater human potential went off the table as well. When Esalen started, there were 10 universities that had departments still pursuing psychical research and parapsychology. Now, whatever you may think of the results of formal psychical research and parapsychology, it was streaming into the mainstream discoveries about telepathy, clairvoyance, supernormal capacities that have a tremendous amount of implication for altered states of consciousness, for the development of consciousness, for elevating consciousness, etc. All those things have disappeared. There is one university left in the United States, University of Virginia, that houses such research. I could go on and on about this. Now, meanwhile, Terry, on the other hand, over these 50 years, has been this enormous advance in all sorts of transformative practices. That's been the big win for all our endeavors, I would say, over the last 50 years. For example, you mentioned the advent of somatics. Many practices, Feldenkrais method, Rolfing, so forth. Don Johnson, who's been the philosophic leader of that in the United States, my good friend and a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies. All right, all of the people related to that sort of thing, that's been a great advance. The enormous influence that Buddhism has had in the West, Toynbee was right, and I don't know to say it's the greatest invention of the 21st century, but the advance of meditation practice, of mindfulness, the research that's been done on meditation, nearly 6,000 studies in meditation research, that is an enormous world advance. We could list several fields, or many fields actually, that relate to transformative practice in general. Okay, that's the big win. But the impulse for unifying vision, that's been, I would say, the great disappointment for me. And where there is no vision, the people will perish. So there's a very, very quick summary of the whole situation.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. So as you recount that, let's focus just for a moment on the big win, which is this whole matter of integral and transformative practices, both. It might be nice if you'd be willing to tell the story of how you, through your experiments at Esalen, arrived at the conclusion that an integral transformative practice really was the key. And then maybe say a little more about how that inspired your experiments, what that in, you know, how that informed your view, and then maybe we can expand on to what you see emerging since you started ITP.
Well, to say it very quickly, when I started, my impulse in starting Esalen was to create a meeting place. It was not going to be an ashram. We didn't want to fly under a single flag. It was like a tiny college here on the Big Sur coast where people bringing in these new vistas, new perspectives, new practices would have a great meeting place. And so we, along with the thinkers who saw this having a role in the world advance, and so we started to have seminars at first, you know, 30 or 40 a year. Now we do 500 seminars a year. We sell about 15,000 tickets a year. That means some people repeat, maybe 10,000 people a year come through Esalen. By the late 1970s, we started in 62. By the late 1970s, we had a tremendous exposure, and we watched it through, not only through Esalen, but through, there were about 150 centers, Terry, that modeled themselves on Esalen. And then the offerings, which were extremely diverse and included, you know, the various somatic practices, meditation practices, all the practices you could subsume under the search for emotional intelligence. I mean, we never said we were a hospital. We were not primarily a therapeutic center. We were for the education of the emotions, of the inner life. All of that, we had an enormous exposure. But the great learning in those early decades were that the openings that people got in these seminars, now you got to go back to the 60s and 70s, there weren't all the Buddhist centers that, you know, started to flourish. There weren't, in Salinas, where I came from, no one knew what yoga was. My family thought it was, you know, laying down on the bed of nails. But now there are 20,000 yoga studios in the United States. There probably at that time were 20 or 100, but not 20,000. In any case, in those days, people were getting their first exposure to this, but our saying was, if you came for a weekend seminar, by about Thursday of that week, after you'd gone home, the satori faded away, the insight, the joy, and so forth. And this was a constantly repeated experience, so that the dawning across the whole, all the hundreds of thousands of people who opened up to these things in the 60s were that you needed long-term, sustained, daily practice even to sustain the openings, the learnings, the insights that you were having. It's one thing to have an experience. It's another thing to really develop a new attribute or set of attributes or lifestyle to nurture those things. It's so in any case, out of that came George Leonard and my desire to start some sort of practice where a community of people could gather and find each other and sustain long-term practice. The other big insight was that there's a tremendous synergy in working across the various aspects of human functioning. For example, we started collecting studies of exceptional human functioning, including studies of meditation, of visual imagery, of biofeedback, and somatic practices, etc. And the picture that started to emerge was that meditators who got physically fit generally did better than people who were not fit. And then about this time, I was in the middle of this myself, athletes started discovering that mental practice, mindfulness, helped them. And this was everything from golf to archery to football to basketball, and so that mind and body, which mirror one another at all times, when cultivated, it's a principle of 2 + 2 = 5 or 2 + 2 = 7. There's a kind of leap of result when you can combine these disciplines. So that's the idea of the integral, which you've been so involved with, Terry, and which our integral practice is based on. So those two grand principles emerged out of the early decades of our experience at Esalen. Namely, you needed long-term practice to cultivate and preserve what you were getting, and you needed to honor the principle of the integral. So when George Leonard and I started integral transformative practice, you know, our slogan became body, mind, heart, and soul, to cultivate health and fitness, to nurture personal relationships, to develop the mind, and to open up to the vistas beyond mind, so to speak, the spiritual domain. So those two great principles. Now, the other one that figures largely in ITP, Terry, and that was a particular interest and concern of both George and both I and George were concerned with this, and so was Dick Price, with whom I started Esalen. That is that so many of the groups we saw were devolving into really tough cults and were really circumscribing and suppressing the very thing they were trying to nurture. And we, you know, in those years, for those who remember, everything from Jonestown to the Rajneeshis, who were poisoning the city council or whatever they were trying to do up in Oregon. And you saw one of these groups after another getting sicker and sicker. It's like watching wrecks in slow motion. So the whole effort to get beyond the strict guru model into a more of a model of mentorship and even multiple mentorship in groups. So I would say that's a third principle that underlies our particular group. There are a lot of these long-term lessons that we learned along the way that have fed into this. But anyway, that's a first set of things.
That's beautiful. And in that sense, culture really has been changed, as you were saying, that we have something like 20,000 yoga studios across the country. We have a tremendous interpenetration of Buddhist practice and neuroscience and serious discussion of those kinds of issues in the tech companies. There's a kind of mainstreaming of best practices for kind of optimizing human function, at least in terms of conventional human function. Sports psychologists are kind of routine for elite athletes now in a way that was unheard of when you began. You were pioneering that work. So in
That's
that
right.
sense, we really have seen a transformation of culture as people are realizing the importance of practice. And there's almost we can't quite call it universal, but there certainly is a more mainstream understanding of the centrality of that. But it does, you know, I think that the traditional spiritual point of view would be, yeah, but isn't all of that being accepted only insofar as it serves the ego and the conventional striving of the more reductive and materialistic point of view? Has the fundamental presumption of a larger, more unitive view of the meaning and purpose of our lives been somehow kind of repelled? Has the social organism more or less co-opted these elements rather than allowing itself to be more deeply transformed?
Well, you know, Terry, that's absolutely right. I mean, see, that's where the my disappointment comes in. That this huge incursion into Western culture of transformative practice has been often serves people who lead more and more frantic lives. Yoga in the service of going faster. Yoga that feeds the obsessive-compulsive activity of life, the loss of leisure, the franticness, there's definitely, that is one aspect of contemporary life. And the second is that there's been this huge fractalization of viewpoints. The New York Times over the last year have done two cover stories in their Sunday Review, the Sunday Times, we live in a time now that is so antithetical to the big narratives. Now, this comes out of postmodern analysis, you know, and French, so-called French theory, you know, Foucault and Derrida gets master narratives, you know, in other words, big stories of the Hegelian sort about all and everything, you know, for so many thinkers fell into disrepute, and the whole temperament of the age with the very shortened attention span that's represented by, say, Facebook and Twitter, and constantly on the media, constantly on one's computer, constantly with emails, constant communication, that this has, as these two historians of ideas laid out, has kind of chopped up our cognitive capacity into bits. And what it's done is destroy the taste for larger, encompassing visions. And this, I think, is having a subtle and all-pervasive effect on people. But I don't know, Terry. I can say to myself, well, here I am. I'm 81 years old now. I've watched this for so long, and that maybe it's just that younger people see something I don't. Now, on the other hand, you have all sorts of folks, pursuing physical fitness and practicing some kind of meditation. And you can look at that and you can say, well, that's an advance. But at this point, I have to say, I don't know. When I look at the whole scene, whether we're better off now than before, I think in most ways, yes, we have much more access to visions of human possibility and to actual practices than we ever had before. That's an extraordinarily good thing. On the other hand, we're influenced always and everywhere for this fast, frantic, compulsive, always catching up kind of existence. Where's the leisure? But then finally, we've lost the kind of dreams that the Sri Aurobindo ashram were harboring when I was there in the 1950s, that there would be this major advance in consciousness itself towards into the great undiscovered of country, into the undiscovered country of what Aurobindo called the supermind, the next stage of human evolution. That kind of conversation, it was going on at Stanford in the 50s, is not going on at Stanford today or at Berkeley or at Harvard. In any of our universities, it seems to me, except in those small, isolated classes or departments where you find the inspired professor. There's one more thing to be said, though. This is when we look at this, when we're having a conversation like this, Terry, you know, Jeff Kripal, who is a rising superstar, really, in the field of religious studies, he's head of religious studies at Rice University, has a personal friend. He's written the best history of Esalen, and has studied all these sorts of things we're talking about, sees in popular culture and art, in the superhero myths, in science fiction, in much fantasy literature, the imagery of a coming supernature emerging. I think he's right about that. I think very often the artists are like a distant early warning system. They catch on to things, and popular culture often does. So, you know, this has been going on now for decades, with, from Star Wars to Tolkien to, you know, the various superhero myths, and into so many TV programs like, you know, the X-Men and so forth. You have a kind of coming up from the floorboards. So I often say to myself, well, if you look at the culture, if you look at this whole emergence of evolutionary panentheism as a bottom-up phenomena, this kind of coming up through the floorboards, as it were, of the culture, rather than a top-down affair coming from big thinkers and world-famous philosophers. If you look at it that way, maybe the culture is preparing for some grand opening into these undiscovered countries. So, you know, on good days, Terry, I see it that my hopes go there. On down days, it goes over to the other side. But, you know, it's up to us, finally. We make our own lives day by day. And when we practice, there are often answering graces. Something descends from beyond if we open from below. And maybe this is going to happen. Anyway, so I go back and forth on this, Terry, actually about when I... Hello?
Yes, it was just a brief glitch, Mike, but we hear
okay.
You fine.
So anyway, I that's kind of where I am now. In if one asks me how I size up the overall situation, it depends what day you're going to get me on.
Okay, got it. Well, it sounds like this is a day where you can hold both sides, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm drawn from what you're saying right there to bring this down into the lives of those who are with us right now listening to this, or you know, with us in a future now listening to the recording of this conversation. And, you know, as you see that, sometimes more hopeful, sometimes more optimistic, sometimes less, do you arrive in a conviction of the importance of personal practice and a sense that our personal practice has relevance to the, you know, so often we are now global thinkers and we see that what happens in our individual lives is relatively unimportant, and that the interconnection of everything that we care about means that larger systems need to evolve in order for the things we most hope to see to really manifest. And that sense of the futility of what we can do as individuals often discourages passion and commitment, and very often the premise of personal practice is that, you know, what we do really does matter and it really does make a difference, and that even in a time in which there are retrogressive tendencies going on in the macrosphere, we still have a tremendous responsibility, and that our personal practice and our way of relating to the challenges and even in the discouraging phases of our own lives are an expression of this, you know, larger eros that is trying to find its way through, and that we are evolution in action, and that what
Amen.
We do matters.
Well, Terry, I see, if you ask me to take an overview of the culture as a whole, that's where I finally end up agnostic, not knowing, and going back and forth. But if you ask me, what can we do, that's where I get real optimistic. Because, yes, every one of us can, through practice, further our own development and the world's development. Absolutely. That's the optimist zone. You know, get down here on the earth plane, have your practice, and watch the results. And if you are trying to marry a personal practice, you know, to social action, whatever you're doing, and you can see, you see the results, the practical results of how you can serve, and you see it. So up close, I'm an optimist. When I stand back and look at the whole, I go back and forth. That would be the simple way to say this. Absolutely. It's through practice that we open the windows into hope and into real transformation. I mean, that's, it's the only way. But, you know, it does help to have good maps, to have orienting visions. And I do wish that our culture was more hospitable to leaders who were trying to bring forth those maps. But so be it. You got to work, you got to dance with who brung you. And we're working in a world right now that is what it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, it expresses itself in a lot of different ways. You mentioned the suppression of parapsychology. And, you know, you've paid a great deal of attention to supernormal human and even non-human abilities, especially human abilities. And there's tremendous documentation of non-ordinary psi, psychokinesis, and all extraordinary memory, all kinds of things in the parapsychological literature that have been progressively marginalized and ignored. And yet, in the midst of this, you know, I had a conversation with Michael Dowd, who's someone who appeared in an earlier stage of this. He's a brilliant guy, a wonderful evolutionary evangelist, but he has embraced what he calls evidence-based spirituality, and he has embraced a kind of materialist view in most respects. And in a private conversation, he said to me he didn't even think there was such a thing as scientific fundamentalism. He didn't recognize it. And yet, I've had other conversations with people, as you have, as we all have, who have recognized that there's something more than the material and rational dimensions of things, but then who slip into a kind of over-credulity. And this is why, you know, this idea of magical New Age thinking, you know, we're all tarred by that brush because of the excesses of those who are less rigorous. And I know you've always been, you know, really fierce about trying to cut this middle path in which the foolishness on both sides of that, of, you know, the excesses of the pre-trans fallacy on one hand, and a kind of lack of critical awareness of the limitations of rationality on the other, you know, are tending to limit discourse.
Right.
You know, what are the defining characteristics of a path that avoids falling into either extreme?
Well, you know, in my book, The Future of the Body, I was by far my most ambitious attempt to bring order to the various data about supernormality. It was based on a study we did at Esalen. We collected 10,000 studies of the supernormal functioning, and in doing that, it can be accessed through the Esalen Institute. It's Esalen, E-S-A-L-E-N, CTR, Center for Theory and Research. You go up there to the website, excellentctr.org, and you can access this through keyword search. But anyway, out of those studies, I wrote The Future of the Body, and the main move I made, because we were developing a massive catalog of catalogs of supernormal powers. You know, in the Hindu-Buddhist traditions, there are countless lists, Terry, of, you know, the 10 Bhumis and the 8 Mahasiddhis and the all the different kinds of Siddhis, supernormal powers that emerge in yoga, you know, Deha Siddhis and Ananda Siddhis, et cetera, et cetera. And to kind of wondering and asking, how do you make sense of all this vast explosion of supernormal capacities that have been named in the great transformative disciplines, the great wisdom traditions, and so forth? It occurred to me that the simple way to see them, there's a self-evident taxonomy, namely that every human attribute, every attribute that every human shares, which was inherited from our animal ancestors, take, you know, perception of the outer world, kinesthetic sensitivity, communication abilities, the capacity for love, and so forth. All of them all siddhis can be seen to comprise supernormal expressions of universally shared human attributes. So, for example, you say the kind of movement abilities we inherit, you know, to run, to breathe, to feats of strength, whatever. All those supernormal capacities that have been named in Hindu Buddhist practice, for example, such as increased strength, you name it, there are terms in Sanskrit for all these things. It all falls out that way, and I sketched out an outline for 12 sets of these 12 human attributes. If I did a new edition of the book, there'd be far more than 12 attributes. But in other words, all these attributes tend to give rise across cultures among men and women, young and old, of supernormal versions of themselves. And this kind of pops out at you when you study this in sport, which I've done for decades now, and have talked to hundreds of athletes about these events. Well, once you recognize this, that this supernormal capacity is flickering at the edge of all our functioning in everyday life. The person I know has gotten a PhD in the supernormal siddhis, or powers that emerge among great chefs in kitchens, if you can believe this.
Really?
Yeah, amazing things that happen. I mean, really, the stories, Jenny Wade's book on transcendental sex, all the supernormalities in the bedroom. I mean, that's quite a vast literature. You're not going to find it in Masters and Johnson or in Kinsey, but in Jenny Wade, it's equivalent to William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, the varieties of supernormal erotic experience. In sport, if it's in sport and it's in cooking and it's in lovemaking, you can look for it everywhere. And, of course, right now, given the great engine of contemporary business world, there are all these books about this sort of thing happening in the world of business. In other words, this is one of the great underground stories, I would say, the emergence of the supernormal in everyday life. Now, once you recognize that, you can bring it in to your daily practice. And that's what we're trying to do now with our ITP. I'm going to lecture about it this Wednesday for people in the Bay Area if they want to come. It's over on Belvedere Island at St. Stephen's Church. We have the series of lectures, ITP lectures. But in any case, this is an ongoing enterprise in the ITP world right now, is the embrace, the recognition, and the cultivation of the supernormal as it arises in all our attributes. And in this, Terry, we're kind of breaking out of some of the boxes that people have made around the notion of, quote, enlightenment. If they've done, you know, there's a lot of stuff in Buddhism or Vedanta practice in which the siddhis are proscribed. They're said to lead us away from enlightenment. This is a more Aurobindonian, actually more tantric worldview that says all our human attributes are wanting to go into God, as it were, are wanting to blossom. But you've got to recognize it. You've got to see what's happening and not stomp on it, not suppress it. On the other hand, you can't, practice has to be balanced. It has to be aimed toward the core realizations of, that are the, is where the arrow of, say, Zen practice or the finest transformative practice are aimed at the very heart of God, as it were. But this blossoming out around that core practice of the supernormal aspects, once recognized, can be harvested. I think that will empower practice and broaden practice going forward so that, let's say, very aspirational practices that are aiming very high can meet these kind of everyday practices that you were pointing to there, which look like a co-optation. In other words, why, you know, doing yoga for better sex or to make a better business deal and all of that, that's not, you know, the best way into the undiscovered country of our latent supernature. But often doorways are open that way. Sri Aurobindo was marvelous about that. He said, the same thing Jesus was supposed to have said. By their fruits ye shall know them, not their roots. Their fruits, not their roots. He talks about the famous mystic, one of the greatest of all mystics, who was opened by the touch of a prostitute into the love of God. And he also talked, you know, a lot in his interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita that Arjuna, who did not want to fight, was told by Krishna, you know, Krishna will stand on the chariot with you, Arjuna. The opponents are dead already. You have to do the will of God. And Aurobindo, because he was advocating during World War II that, passive resistance could work against the British. He was one of the first leaders of the Indian independence movement, but would not work against Hitler and later against Stalin. So therefore, on the battlefield itself, he said, people are led to the divine. I mean, it was his version of Krishna's message in the Gita. But in any case, what's at work here is the meeting a very explicit spiritual practice with this emergent practice that's blossoming around in everyday life. And I think this is something that we all should keep our eye on and is happening willy-nilly all over the place. I don't know. I'm just covering a lot of ground.
Well, it's good. I want us to wander pretty broadly. You know, I think I want to circle back to, we've only kind of tangentially spoken about your essay on evolutionary panentheism, which I really love. And, you know, in a sense, it seems to me that what you're saying there, for one thing, you're helping us understand a little better the, you know, both ancient and more recent historical roots of that view, and particularly its crystallization in the early German idealists. But then I think what you're kind of pointing out is that this more adequate worldview has been kind of clarifying and becoming more specific and adequate and fully articulated and linked to objective evidence, you know, for a long time. And that even though in some sense it's being excluded and it's operating on the margins of mainstream culture, you know, it much more adequately accounts for human experience. And that at this time, while we're well into a moment of larger scale crisis, and mainstream culture is kind of enduring this backlash against our most advanced capacities and our capacity to understand it, to have an integrated meta-narrative that makes sense of it. And there's this postmodern reaction against our ability to see the big picture. Do you see this, this evolutionary panentheistic view? You know, it sounds to me like you're feeling that we need to see it and understand it and understand its pervasiveness and ordinariness and, in a sense, own it more fully. But maybe that's the purpose your essay is partly intended to serve?
That's very well said, Terry. I mean, absolutely. Yes, I honor this bottom-up approach, whether it's happening through artists and popular culture or through even practices that seem banal and are co-opting the spiritual impulse, and certainly through all the people who are practicing various forms of mindfulness and so forth. Let's call that the bottom up. I would like to see, I want to strengthen the top down, as it were. In other words, the meta-narrative, that's right. I mean, where there is no vision, the people will perish. And God bless him, this is what Ken Wilber has been working on all these years, to provide a larger framework, an epistemology, you know, his all-quadrant approach. It has this vision, has, as you say, there was a first kind of explosive appearance in a for at least for post-Enlightenment Europe among with Fichte and Schelling and Hegel. And then in subsequently in people like Henri Bergson, Teilhard de Chardin, Whitehead, Hartshorne, and of course in Sri Aurobindo, who was the greatest practicing contemplative of all these great thinkers. So, but it's kind of trying to be born. It's a lineage in the making, but it's not an explicit lineage, Terry, in the way when you talk about Kantians or Platonists or Hegelians, there's a more of a straight through line, you know, a kind of a line through. This is a meandering lineage, you could say, or it's a lineage in the making. And I'm saying it's a stealth worldview. It's emerging piece by piece by piece, pixel by pixel almost, as if from the mists of Brigadoon. It's trying to appear. And a lot of people hold it implicitly. Now, you know, Mark Gaffney has been you know, who comes out of a kind of, you know, I would call it the Jewish way in. It's very modern and very evolutionary. And he talks about dual citizenship in that we can, you know, be rooted in a particular tradition and yet kind of implicitly embracing this global perspective of evolutionary panentheism. For example, Paul Tillich, he actually used the term evolutionary panentheism. Paul Tillich did. Teilhard is a Catholic. Abraham Kook, who Mark Gaffney has taught me about as a great Jewish mystic philosopher, had an evolutionary vision as I get him through Mark Gaffney, and certainly Aurobindo for Indians. In other words, you can be rooted in a tradition and yet start to embrace this profounder, I would say, broader perspective that can start shaking off the superstitions and the dogmas and, yes, even the tyrannies that exist in many of these traditions. You know, in so many profoundly religious Christian types, particularly Christian fundamentalists who are profoundly anti-gay, let's say, or Mormonism, which until recently felt that black folks couldn't participate. Now, Mormonism has tossed that off to a large extent, not altogether, I understand, but it's trying to throw it off. All of us, no matter where we start, we can stay within our traditions. We have to start throwing off these outmoded superstitions, dogmas, what William James called overbeliefs, that often accompany genuine spiritual illumination. The great winnowing is going on around the world in the global village. It's we've got to winnow out the wheat from the chaff. And so all of this is at work. But for that, you know, it really helps to have better maps, to have a luminous narrative. And it doesn't have to be complicated either, I don't think. I think if we see the main lines of it, it's helpful for orientation in our practice. I mean, just to go meditate, you know, for an hour a day and then rush out into the world when, and let's say you're working on Wall Street. I know some guys who work in the financial markets who meditate, and then you go out where you're trying to beat the hell out of the next guy on making the quickest trade, or, you know, it's, I mean, you're working at cross purposes, it seems to me.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's there, perhaps, that you might be articulating a an important truth that is underrepresented in the current dialogue, as so many people are, in a sense, reverse engineering the body-mind by applying principles of neuroscience, neuropsychology, and other techniques that simply optimize our functioning. I think you're helping all of us be reminded that our deepening, our excellence, our expression of our optimal human capacities needs to humbly be a student of the great sweep of life and not be so caught up in the momentum of a kind of hyper accelerando that's part of our current moment.
Amen. Yeah. Amen, brother. No, well said, Terry. That's amen.
And that maybe the grasping of the simple arc of now, why don't you define evolutionary panentheism? What, you know, just in a few words, you said it doesn't have to be complicated. What is it?
Well, I say that you get, you know, in William James, a cash value, you get a lot out of this pragmatically. I say that there are three principles only, I think, lock you into it. One, you have to accept the facts of evolution as they're being revealed by modern science. Number one, yes, the various domain theories come and go. I mean, for example, just exactly how the Big Bang works, there's still, you know, a lot of questions about that. There are a lot of questions about, you know, epigenesis now. In other words, we're not ruled completely by DNA. We're not completely ruled by natural selection. Okay, all of those domain theories, as it were, within the various fields of science are changing, but the overall fact of evolution, you have to accept that. Secondly, it does require that you believe the divine is both transcendent to and immanent in the world. Now, for that, you have to come to that one way or another, through intuition, direct experience. You can say to yourself through a deep spiritual knowing, through reason, however you come to that. And then the third principle, I think, to lock it in as a worldview is that the deepest roots of the human self, the deepest roots of human nature, are at least profoundly intimate with the divine from which this cosmos arises, and more probably identical with it. That Atman, the deepest subjectivity we have, Atman, is Brahman, the omnipresent reality, that which is in all things. We are one with all. Once you have those three principles, I want to argue now. Now, some of my pals who are sharing this with me would argue for two or three more, but it gives you a working framework. And what I've done in this essay is outline several dozen immediate goods you get once you lock in on those three principles. You get oriented in your practice among my colleagues in our research and in our theory building. So in all three, in our immediate practice, our research, and our theory building, this provides good bones. A deep structure, essential bones. Now, there are these immediate profound questions that we've had to answer, and I've been working on this, as you know, for 14 years through our fellowship at Esalen on the research on postmortem survival, back to William James. And I've signed on now to the overwhelming evidence for reincarnation, particularly through Ian Stevenson's work, 2,600 case studies of kids who remember a past life, and this has been checked out, and we've been quite involved in this at Esalen through our Esalen Center for Theory and Research Fellowship, and it's growing. There are about 40 of us now in daily contact around the issues, and it's back to the Society of Psychical Research is reviving that whole agenda. But in any case, reincarnation, Sri Aurobindo was believed in it. He had great influence on me, but I've been agnostic about it until I've been overwhelmed by the evidence. So, but I was operating under the whole premise, the founding premises of what I would call evolutionary panentheism from day one. I mean, I locked into that when I was 20. The fact of reincarnation I've locked into recently, overwhelmed by the evidence for it. Now, there's much else that I would now say is established as fact, that some of my very best friends, who are very spiritually open and sensitive people, would not say is established as facts. For example, I do believe the flesh itself can manifest the glories of the spirit in the way some of these mainly heretical characters in the Tibetan lore and in the Christian tradition and in Zen and in shamanism say. The evidence for it, I think, is everywhere. A lot of my friends are agnostic about that. In other words, we can all, there's a gang of us who can operate within this world that's revealed to us, or rather opened up to us through evolutionary panentheism, and yet disagree about very fundamental issues, including reincarnation or the what's the future of human flesh itself. I mean, these are really, you know, this gets pretty far out. But you see, the point I'm making is, I think that if we could name this big framework that's there for us and accept it, wow, a lot of us can start working together around this and stop having the kinds of what I consider now fatuous, silly, distracting arguments about, oh, you know, God's immanence and transcendence and, you know, and I even have a few friends who still wondering about evolution itself. And I mean, I'm just tired. I don't join those discussions anymore. I mean, let's move on into higher country here and get on with the work.
You know, in fact, you in the essay used a wonderful phrase that I just kind of want to bring out. You're not only interested to move on, you have the sense that the clarity of this vision in the hearts of people all over the place is, as you put it in the essay, like a coiled spring, ready to perhaps yield things far beyond what we can see now, just as the discoveries of Einstein and Bohr yielded the atomic bomb only 50 years later, or less than 50 years later. There may be potentials in this worldview that are going to be quite astonishing, and you have some sense that that's a possibility.
Yeah, well, I know, I definitely think so. Whenever you have the emergence of a new worldview or a grand theory, say like relativity or quantum theory, the founders themselves don't see all the consequences down the road, and I think that's the case here. I mean, Henri Bergson, Teilhard de Chardin, certainly Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel did not see what you can get out of it, given what we know empirically now. This is the other power. A great theory can suddenly bring a whole body of data into the light, and you have an explosive coming together there. I mean, for example, you know, Mendel, you know, with his sweet peas, had come up basically with these fundamental laws of genetics, but it took Charles Darwin's whole, you know, framing, but it wasn't Darwin himself. It was, William Bateson, the father of Gregory Bateson, who was mainly responsible for putting Mendel together with Darwin. The point being that, in other words, the grand theory comes in, and suddenly it reaps an immense harvest right from what was there under your nose. And this is the case, I think, with this. Evolutionary panentheism, if it starts to spread, has got a lot of data waiting there to sprout in its light, you see. It's like the sun rising over all these little seedlings that are there. That's wanting to happen. And that's what I'm trying to contribute to right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I just want to keep rolling, but there are a couple of important announcements, and I know a lot of folks want to be able to ask us questions. So if you want to pose a question to Mike or to me, press star 2 if you've dialed in by phone to raise your hand, or type your question into the Instant Teleseminar window on your computer if you're listening via the webcast. I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about Mike Murphy's work. You know, first of all, I highly recommend reading some of his wonderful nonfiction and or fiction books. And certainly a visit to Esalen is always a joy. But on the web, I recommend visiting ITP, Integral Transformative Practice, -international.org. Integral Transformative Practice International is the organization that grew organically out of the experiment from 92-93 in creating an integral practice community, and they support people from all over the world to support each other in engaging a long-term program for realizing the potential of body, mind, heart, and soul. And for those of you in the Bay Area, you can go onto that website and you can find out the details about the in-person lecture that Mike is going to be giving on Wednesday night. And then also you'll find out about an event in August, a Golf in the Kingdom Marathon in San Rafael, California, that will feature a dialogue between Mike and Bobby Clampett. So all that information and a copy of his essay on evolutionary panentheism are available at itpinternational.org. Is there anything else that you want me to point people to, Mike, if they're interested to find out more about your work?
Well, I would recommend, too, they can get a report on this work at Esalen on postmortem survival. It's called Irreducible Mind. Irreducible Mind by Kelly and Kelly. It's the publisher Roman and Littlefield. You can, Amazon, or you can get that through the Esalen CTR website. And then there is another event, Terry, ITP event at Esalen, actually, August 3rd to 5th. We're going to take over most of Esalen for a weekend program there. We're going to look back at 20 years of this ITP experiment and a kind of a big report from the front, so to speak.
Great. Good. Thank you, Mike. I also want to make sure that you know about my online course in integral spiritual practice, I call it. It's another expression of this same impulse that has been designed, really, in order to be practically available to people all over the world without a lot of travel. It's an 8-session course to activate your conscious evolution and awaken the full potential of your body, mind, and spirit. And you can find out more about that at ISP, like Integral Spiritual Practice, ispcourse.com. And I am really happy about what emerged from the creative process that created that online course. I had the privilege to learn from Mike and George. I worked with Ken Wilber on Integral Life Practice. And I think what I've been able to generate is a unique transformational learning program that combines recordings, in-person meetings by phone, and the online functions that really can take you wherever you live, step by step, through the process of establishing a daily and doable and heartfelt integral spiritual practice, and to do so with the support of a worldwide community of other sincere practitioners. And this course will be starting soon. So I encourage you to take a look at it at ispcourse.com. We'll be holding a course orientation this Thursday, June 14th, and then the course itself will be starting June 21st. So please check it out at ispcourse.com. And then please stay on the line. At the end of the call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. I've got a lot to tell you about there. I'll be talking with Carter Phipps about his new amazing new book, Evolutionaries, that really speaks to some degree about this worldview. That'll be in 3 weeks on July 1st. Okay, let's take a look at some of the questions that have come in. Here's an interesting simple question. Barbara from Laguna Beach asks you, Mike, is human evolution really about the evolution of consciousness, or is it the evolution of the body, or evolution of the spirit, or who we really are? she hears a lot, I think, about the evolution of consciousness, and she's wondering about these different emphases, you know?
Yeah, well, it's all of those, certainly. If we're serious about a spiritual development, and we're practicing a meditation or whatever, we're going to have hormonal changes. We're going to have, electrochemical events in the brain. We're going to change our brain. The brain is to some degree like a muscle. It changes with practice. And I firmly believe that we do have subtle bodies. We don't know yet, I believe, exactly. As a learned community around the world, we don't actually know all the varieties and permutations of the so-called subtle body, but it too will change. And our lives will change. And so evolution proceeds always as a psychophysical. Body, mind, heart, and soul are all co-evolving. And of necessity, this has to involve our social relationships. The institutions we inhabit, our environment. So it's a holistic process, inescapably. So that's the basic way I see it.
Yeah, great. I entirely agree. Let me take another question from the webcast. Ernest in Oakland asks a really interesting question. For better or worse, do you think that the major evolutionary changes, at least in the near term, may not be in terms of individual development, but instead in terms of larger structures and macro issues, such as the rise and dominance of corporations, both for good and ill, impact of information technology, thinking globalization or Ray Kurzweil's ideas, the manipulation of life itself, thinking in terms of biotech, synthetic biology, and so forth, and the struggle for ecological sustainability in an age that we may call the Anthropocene era?
Well, that of course, is happening. Life is always evolving. I think we have to distinguish. This is a thing all of us have got to get straight about. Evolution is not always progressive. To say something is evolving is simply to say it's orderly change in a certain direction, or an ordered change in a certain direction, and a typically irreversible change. But it doesn't mean it's necessarily progressive. If you're going to say it's a progressive thing, you have to have criteria that of progress. So if you look at most 99% of the living species that have lived on Earth are no longer with us. Virtually every culture that was of the past is gone. We have an emerging culture. Now, you can say that evolution meanders more than it progresses. Whether you're looking at when you stand back and you see that civilizations rise and they fall. Think of all the people you know, and you look at their lives. Have they really grown through their life, all of them? Some of them have. Have all of them? How are they all doing right now? Are they going forwards, backwards, sideways, in circles? What about ourselves? This is a tough, tough truth, if you take a look at it. But if you stand back far enough, you see that against the background of this vast meandering, life has advanced. There was the Big Bang, and out of this inanimate matter on this earth emerged life, and life from single cells. Now here are these human creatures, and these human creatures are giving birth to prodigies that couldn't be guessed at. They're doing things. Their athletes are running faster than humans ran before. Are producing all sorts of prodigies. We're inventing things. We went to the moon. We're planning to go to Mars. We're probing the universe. So if you stand back far enough, wow, now, what about ourselves? Each of us, Each of us, every one of us can emerge, can evolve, can do something. We really can, but we got to do it. If we just sit around and, you know, play tiddlywinks, we're not going to get there. So it's up to us. And then if we stand back and make these big global statements about what's going on everywhere, you look at some of these great financial experiments. They've thrown tens of millions of people out of work. It's ruined lives. Many of these big banking ventures have destroyed lives. Look at these wars. I mean, did we have to go to a war in Iraq? Did we have to do that? Maybe so, maybe not. We certainly had to deal with terrorism. I think we'd all agree that we had to do that. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, anyway, that's...
Yes. Well, you know, as you're saying that, I want to point out that in talking about how evolution meanders and then saying that in the big picture we do see progress, you know, implicit in that is a definition of what progress is. And it
right.
would seem to me that you're affirming the principles that you might find in Teilhard or Wilbur, which seem to argue that the progress is in the direction of more consciousness, more complexity, more interconnectivity,
yes.
more cooperation.
Yes.
Are there
okay.
other definitions
what direction
progress lies that you would add
well,
to
let
those?
Me say, the prime vector for me in evolutionary panentheism, let me say it again, that once you say evolution is a fact, and once you say the divine is transcendent immanent, that the divine was implicit in the Big Bang. In other words, the divine emanated, you can use the language, involved itself in the birth of the physical universe. And in Schelling's words, the Deus implicitus, that is the divine that's implicit, that is undisclosed, that is wrapped up in matter, but is implicit in matter, in the course of times becomes the Deus explicitus. So God is waking up. The divine is manifesting gradually in its fuller glories in the course of evolution. Evolution indeed is the divine becoming more manifest. That's the prime vector. That's the prime truth. That's what it's all about. This is the game of games. This is what's up, Alfie. God is waking up. And we are the agents of it now on Earth, because consciousness is coming to itself, to know itself, to recognize itself. That's the game of games. That's time's arrow. That's what it is.
And in that process, God may roll over and yawn and doze for a while and then gradually get up bit by bit.
Yes.
It isn't simply linear.
And that's right. And we have to parse it out further and say that the divine, the agents of the divine are myriads of souls. If this is indeed the case now, this is the what I would call evolutionary panentheism in its more developed form, is that the souls would be the agents of evolution, and in their evolution, they are furthering the cosmic advance, the divine disclosure. That's what I believe, that all of us, certainly, at least conceivably, I think it's a fact. But for those who don't want to say it's a fact and just say they can imagine it or conceive it, that the souls are agents of the world game and are driving it. But some of us are asleep. Some of us are half awake. A few are more fully awake. And that's what's going on right now. And some of the folks who are very powerful and asleep can lead us in awful directions. And because we're all so suggestible, we get ourselves hypnotized by silly and sometimes very destructive people and are led down blind alleys and into byways, and we lead the world's meandering or contribute to it.
Which means then, at the end of the day, that what we do matters and that our practice is penultimate. It's just really
Amen.
Always a priority.
Amen.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, I want to take a live question, and we have a couple of callers queued up. One from Massachusetts, a 978 area code. You are unmuted. Well, let's see. Are you unmuted? Now you are. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, Terry and Michael. This is Joe Caratindudel.
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. I've read some of your books and really enjoy them and your ideas. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
So what's your question, Joe?
My question, I guess you led up to it well there, talking about souls. And it seems to me a lot of your work is focused around humans, obviously. What, in your experience and exposure, do you have to say about non-humans and the role that they play?
Well, the role they play, do you mean now or in the lead up to the emergence of humankind?
Now. Would you say animals have souls? Or,
you mean like our relationship with our pets and things like that, Joe? Is that what you're focusing on?
Right, or even, you know.
Well, Aurobindo, my teacher, and many other great mystics have believed that animals have souls, and they definitely have soul. I mean, anybody who's ever had a pet, and certainly if you've had a dog, I mean, they become profoundly human, and many of them are much, much nicer than, you know, most of the humans we actually know. I mean, they're marvelous. I believe they have souls, and I think it's probably the case that they're involved in the evolution too. I mean, they had to have been involved before the advent of humankind. So I think what we have now on Earth, certainly, and we presume on some other planets somewhere, a whole scale of being, from the simplest animals up to humans, and we're all in the game together. That's what I believe, and that the entire environment, in fact, even inanimate objects, I really do believe this, and the evidence for it. Now, this is a whole other program, Terry and Joe, but that inanimate objects, as certainly all living things, are secretly divine, and that the deepest part of us can connect to the deepest part of them. And you see the loyalty of the bonds that form between animals and humans. It's love. I mean, it's, you know, why do so many people say that they've had more unconditional love from their pet dog than they have had from anyone? I mean, you know, I have people who say that, but so animals have soul, the whole world has soul, and we meet one another most deeply at that level, so they're in the game. Now, Joe, but I don't know, this is a long conversation. If you mean what's the role of animals in, you mean the general environment at a practical level, or are you just asking
In Terry's integral spiritual practice, we refer to our human and non-human family.
Right.
And it seems to me in a lot of leading edge circles, the non-human family is not mentioned. And
Yeah. Well,
so I guess I was looking for you know, just your
yeah.
take on that.
Well, yeah, but you can't like how does I mean, every particle in the universe, as far as I'm concerned, you know, once you see it, once you buy into this worldview, you have to see the divine as implicit in everything. And I argue strongly, Joe, that that's why psychokinesis itself works. This is why athletes love the, let's say, their balls and bats, their canoe, their surfboard. They start talking to the instruments. And certainly it's true of those involved in intimate relation with animals. Now, yes, we do kill animals to eat them. This is going on. But in many traditional cultures, and certainly in the Paleolithic era, I mean, there was often a sacred aspect of it, that in the Native American culture, when you killed a deer, there was a prayer that went with it. We've lost that for the most part in modern culture. So a truly integral practice is going to bring us around to a new attitude. That's why many people are vegetarian and will not eat animals. And it's, but this is a, oh boy, this gets into incredible ethical complexities and then complexities of practice. It's a huge question, Joe. It's very, very much up for us at Esalen these days. This question is just loaded because we have our, you know, we feed ourselves down there. We have, you know, a big organic garden. It's one of the leading ones in California. And so, for example, what do you do about the gophers? You know, and what do you do? What do you do about the bugs even? And we promote the bugs. Because to fertilize, you know, the plants, I mean, it's, you know, there can be environmental fundamentalisms too. I'm not an environmental fundamentalist. I think we have to, the moral dimensions of environmentalism and sustainability, you know, are quite complex. And that's why you have a field of bioethics now and environmental ethics. And it's, these are not easy questions, no matter from what level of understanding you ask them. So anyway,
thank you for touching on those themes.
It's an enormous question. It's an enormous question.
I especially like the idea of the prayer with the animal, you know, recognize.
Well, it's a sacred, well, anyway, but we've, oh boy.
Well, I think we should move on. Thanks so much for your question, Joe. That was great. I think that really added something to our discourse.
It's a huge question.
Yeah, it is. It is huge. I'd like to ask, you know, Mike, we're going a little over the 11:30 mark. I hope that's okay. There are a few other questions I'd like to at least touch on before
I can go to 12.
Okay, well, we can't go quite that long. We just, the folks weren't expecting it, but I want to go a little longer. Deborah from Laguna Hills asks, there's so much talk among spiritual teachers and seekers these days about the law of attraction and keeping your vibration high in order to manifest good things. What do you think about all that? Where does karma fit in?
Well, certainly there are mutual attractions everywhere, in the inorganic world, among us humans. Vibrations, certainly we know what that means. If you're getting at the whole notion of, you know, you meet someone and it's as if you know them secretly, there are certainly given affinities, unusual affinities. I think as you get older, after you've been wounded by so many false synchronicities, attractions that seemed preordained that turned out to be deadly, you know, so many disappointments in young love. I don't know where the question comes from exactly, but, you know, we have to be careful with these grand ideas about natural attraction and karmic vibes. I think she was maybe talking
about the law of attraction, the idea that keep your thoughts and your energy in the positive and you'll attract good things and manifest what you want to, the law of attraction idea.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, absolutely. You've got to, you know, you've got to, you know, you've got to recognize that. I mean, we're making our own karma on a moment-by-moment basis. And so, yeah, absolutely. We're creating an atmosphere around us at all times. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And yet the attitude that we're simply going to, like, manifest, you know, a new Chevrolet, you know, or a new Cadillac, actually. You know, that it gets taken to extremes, of course. And
absolutely. I mean, it's, I mean, it can be taken to extremes.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to take one more live question. We have, I think I recognize this might be Sam in Michigan. Hi, Sam. Welcome.
It's good to
be here today. Your question?
Well, Mike, I really appreciate the being able to wander through the labyrinth of the mind in this way, you know. And usually I'm kind of wandering and it's not really doing a whole lot. It's not really useful. But today I feel that it's sort of a psychedelic type of vitamin for my mind to allow me. I feel that somehow I'm able to kind of trace it back, you know, and trace it back to koans, maybe where I've gotten lost, and actually bring it back to the integral synthesis. I'm working on it. And my question is sort of like an intuitive thing, and I appreciate where I'm kind of out of my league and over my head with the psychedelicism, you know, but Terry and I have been having kind of a long conversation of bringing through this type of mind power. And I don't think so much we're talking about mind powers or cities like I'm going to get super strong, I'm going to lift weights and do Vipassana, and we're going to have telepathy because that's one of my target goals and we got it. But what I'm thinking is that the goal of using the material, like the psychedelicism, like the wandering of the mind in horizontal development, and then to bring it up to the present time of vertical development that we really need to do, and being able to plot, you know, how am I doing telepathy on the Wilbur Combs matrix or whatever, and really appreciate the spaces and the places and the hidden internals where we can come together in this lucidity of ours, and really start to create a framework of how to discuss the lysergic psychic experiment that right now I just don't even know where I'm at with being able to talk about it. But as always, I appreciate it. And I don't know what question is going to emerge here, but I feel so overwhelmed with emotion, being able to unwind this spring. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, let me see if I can talk to where you're coming from. I think that... okay, what's the relation to wandering, whether it's in our mind or traveling physically or up and down the spiritual ladder, and some sense of stability and direction? You know, I think inevitably any of us, to get through the day, we need both. But to quicken our practice, generally speaking, we need to settle into stable commitments. We have to get married to our practice. In ITP, we take affirmations. It's a kind of vow taking. And
is that the same as mantra?
Well, a vow is a promise you make to yourself or to God, you can have lifelong vows. This is what a monk or a spiritual aspiration does. You take In the old the church, you took vows of obedience and poverty and chastity. Now, let's say in ITP, we make affirmations for our life affirmations. And then you can make, let's call medium-term ones. I am going to get rid of this particular bad habit. I'm going to work on this, whatever it may be. And then we can make daily vows. This is my vow for today. So I think a life built on daily vows, medium-term vows, and life vows is going to work better. And if you can align those vows with this big vision that God is waking up in the course of time in this cosmos, and I, whoever you are, and my work and my life and my relationships, I want them to open up and thrive in the light of God. As soon as you do this, some magic starts to happen. Now, where does the wandering come in? For me, for example, I find that as I, right now I'm reading a particular book, it's a blockbuster, The Master and His Emissary. It's about the relation of the right and the left brain. This guy is arguing that in the course of the time the left brain has grown too big and it's overcoming. He looks at this whole cultural meander we're in now as driven by the brain itself. I'm learning a lot. It's a vast exploration of brain research and human history. It's quite a thing by Ian McGilchrist. Okay, for me, the experience is that I'm wandering through this thing because it includes so many new things. But it's wandering with a purpose. So all I can say is that in my life, I have had long periods of really on point. And then I've given myself permission to wander some. It's a very general answer, Sam, to speaking to your wandering versus the arrow.
But how do we include filling calls? I'm sorry about that. But and also do the work that we're contracted to do. And my priorities have kind of been a little bit screwed up. But now I'm getting that in order. It really seems we can have it all. And so I appreciate the work that you're doing. And I really am just overjoyed to come together in this way.
Well, good to talk to you, Sam.
Absolutely. And Terry, you as well. Take care, my friend.
All right. Thank you, Sam. All right. Well, Mike.
Well, Terry, thank you, Terry. I have to run myself now.
Okay. Well, we open up the lines. Everybody gets a chance to say goodbye. I'll just take a minute to kind of fill people in. If you value what you've been receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested to learn more about Michael Murphy, please visit itpinternational.org. That's itp-international.org. And act soon to check out my 8-session course on integral spiritual practice at ispcourse.com. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com and sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter. Now, in 3 weeks, on July 1st, I'll be talking with Carter Phipps, author of the important new book, Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. And then on July 15th, I'll be talking with Jim Turner, who's a bona fide Washington, D.C. political attorney who's working hard using the principles of natural healing to break partisan gridlock and offering a rare message of hope. The title of our dialogue will be The Innate Natural Intelligence of the Body Politic. So thank you, everybody, for joining Michael and me today. Let's open up the lines. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, Jerry.
Bye.
Thank you.
Come up to present time. Big stuff.
Thank you, Michael.